Lawyers in Britain, unlike many of their counterparts in the US or elsewhere in Europe, tend to stay behind the scenes. But my guest today on Hard Talk is the glaring exception to that. Mark Lewis has found himself, some would say happily placed himself, at the front and centre of the high-profile government-commissioned inquiry into newspaper ethics. He's the lawyer for victims of phone hacking. He says that he, along with his family, have also been the subjects of secret surveillance by the tabloids. But has he now turned from lawyer to activist? And where could his campaign leave a free press? Mark Lewis, welcome to Hard Talk. Phone hacking is the listening of other people's voicemail messages on their mobile phones without their consent. It's illegal in this country. When did you first realise that newspapers might be doing this?
It became apparent in... I'd blocked a story for Gordon Taylor, the chief executive of the Professional Footballers Association, and Joanne Armstrong, the in-house lawyer. I'd acted for Joanne Armstrong a few months earlier. Then there'd been an arrest of a royal correspondent for the News of the World, Clive Gutman, and Glenn Mulcair. That seemed like a big story at the time. It seemed to then disappear. The two of them pleaded guilty. I would have thought no more of it, but Gordon Taylor's picture was on the news behind the sentencing, and I realised that the story that I'd been told as to the investigation months earlier, that this was a proper journalistic inquiry, was actually nothing of the sort. They'd obviously been hacking a phone, set off through legal means to find out if the voicemail had been intercepted, and yes, the voicemails were intercepted.
You're certain of that?
Oh, 100%. There's no doubt about it whatsoever.
You then pursued that case, and in the wake of that, you gave evidence to a parliamentary committee of inquiry, I think in 2009, where you said that you felt that the practice was so widespread that as many as 6,000 people had their phones hacked into. How did you get from just one case, Gordon Taylor, the boss of the Professional Footballers Association, to 6,000?
What had happened is I recounted a conversation that I say took place. The Metropolitan Police still deny it took place, between me and a police officer, where he told me that there had been 6,000 victims. I made it clear to the parliamentary inquiry that it wasn't that there were necessarily 6,000 phones that had been hacked. It could have been 6,000, including the people who had left messages. And what you have to be aware of is, at that time, it was thought that there was just a handful of victims of phone hacking. The 8 or 9 people who'd been in the initial Glenn Mulcair and Clive Gutman investigation, no one knew it was much more widespread. And, of course, it's now transpired that the police have indicated there were something in the region, I think, 5,795 names, of which 803 are people who are victims, which I take to mean as people who have had their voicemails hacked. An uncanny coincidence with the numbers that I put forward.
But there was widespread disbelief at the time, wasn't there, that amount of phone hacking could have gone on. You were told, essentially, that you had been misleading members of Parliament.
The accusation was put to me that I'd been misleading. I was almost the lone voice crying in the wilderness saying, no, believe me, this is much bigger than people are saying. But there was a propaganda almost being put out by a wall of silence by newspapers, not just News International, but other newspapers, suggesting it was a left-wing plot between The Guardian, maybe The Independent, and something I was doing, saying it was bigger. And
there wasn't just a sense of opposition from other newspapers. I mean, your own law firm told you, from what I understand, not to take up other phone hacking cases. Is that correct?
Well, what had happened is they gave me an ultimatum. In July 2009, The Guardian had run a story. I was about to be instructed, I had been instructed, to pursue a case for someone else. My old law firm gave me an ultimatum that within an hour I had to decide whether I would... the choice they gave me was not to act for any other victims of phone hacking or leave.
Why?
They just reached that decision. I mean, you'd have to ask them why they reached that decision.
Well, I mean, what did you take from that, though? That they thought that there wasn't going to be any money in it, or that they were under some sort of pressure?
I don't think they were. You must have asked them the question.
I
didn't have chance to ask them the question. It's simply when I got a message on my BlackBerry at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning saying, here is an ultimatum, you've got to give us an undertaking that you won't act for other victims of phone hacking by 11 o'clock, you won't appear on Newsnight, which is what I told them I was had been asked
another
to do.
Another BBC programme.
Another BBC programme. And in fact, what happened was by the time I said, well, can I have a look at my partnership agreement, I was told I'd been expelled as a good leaver, that I'd not done anything wrong, but I was no longer a part of the
law firm. So you left the law firm, and you then began a descent into quite difficult personal circumstances, didn't you?
I'd always had a job. I'd always been working, and after 20 years of working for a living as a lawyer, I was suddenly without a job. I'd been told that I was cast out on my own. I'd said at the time that I wanted to do this for me and my partners in the law firm, but all of a sudden I was left without a law firm and having to find a job. It was a very difficult financial time, emotional time, going through all sorts of matters dealing with that, but without a firm behind me for a very short period of time.
How did you deal with it?
Well, it, in a way, it dealt with me rather than me dealing with it. When I thought that things couldn't go wrong, or any further wrong, I then got a letter from News of the World's lawyers saying that they were threatening to see me. They told me that it was rare that we have to admonish a fellow professional for acting, but there's still time for you to do the right thing. So I not only had lost my job or was without a job, but I had the whole weight of News International and Rupert Murdoch threatening to sue me and seek an injunction against me. It was those circumstances that led me to having to give evidence to Parliament to say, look, somebody has to hear about this.
And you were also dealing, I know it didn't come on at the same time, but you were dealing with the debilitating medical condition of multiple sclerosis as well.
Well, yes, I have got MS. I didn't choose to have MS. I didn't choose to go public about it, but it became more and more obvious. I was under a lot of physical pressure. You know, you're not meant to get stressed when you're having MS, and there I was going through the stress of losing my job and also the stress of having to take everyone on. It was really, everybody seemed to be coming at me. The one thing I haven't got in my character is an ability to say, all right, I'll go away and I'll just take it.
But you had specific advice from your doctor, from what I understand, not to pursue this matter. They said, for heaven's sake, don't put yourself through it because of your MS.
What had been said, to be fair, was you're meant to have a review every year to see how you're doing. I don't look after myself as though I suppose I should do. But the last time I went to my consultant, probably 4 or 5 years ago, the consultant had said to me, you know, are you still working? There was a presumption that I might not be working at all. And I said, well, yes, I am. And he said, well, look, as long as you don't do anything stressful, you'll be okay. And actually, the reality of my life and what I was doing is probably the most stressful thing you could be doing.
And it was about to get more stressful because the parents of the murdered schoolgirl, Millie Dowler, got in touch with you.
Yeah, I mean, that happened probably. I ended up, I suppose, to put the story into perspective, I moved from Manchester to London to move job, move cities at an age when most people, probably 45, 46 years old, got MS, moving city to do those things and having to deal with that. And then I get a phone call from Sally Dowler and have a meeting and pursue the case for Millie Dowler.
Sally Dowler being the mother of Millie Dowler, who was murdered back in 2002. She was concerned that Millie, her murdered daughter's phone, may have been hacked into.
The Dowler family were going through the trial at the time of the person who'd murdered their daughter. They were notified by their family liaison officer at Surrey Police that the Metropolitan Police wanted to talk to them because Millie Dowler herself, the murdered schoolgirl, her phone had been hacked. There were other suggestions that their phones might have been hacked and their landline might have been hacked. There is no doubt whatsoever that Millie Dowler's phone was hacked, that her voicemails were listened to. The News of the World have accepted that they did that.
A key part of this story, though, is that when the news broke, when the Guardian newspaper broke the news back in July that Millie Dowler's voicemail had been listened to, they also said that her voicemail had been deleted, her messages had been deleted by a News of the World investigator. That now turns out probably not to have been the case. There seems to be something of a backlash in the media against those who put it about that her voicemail messages were deleted by a News of the World investigator. Do you understand that there is concern that the totally understandable outrage about her voicemail being listened to has now reached a level where perhaps there's been too much of a reaction?
It's not quite right. I mean, look, one, her voicemails were listened to by the News of the World. There is no doubt about that. There is nobody from News International that suggests that anything other than that happened. Nobody from the police suggesting that happened. There has been a suggestion that there is a theory that the deletions of messages... See, what it came is Sally Dowler, the mother, on the 24th of March 2002, suddenly was able to get through to Millie Dowler's voicemail. Previously, she'd not been able to get through to it because there had been automatic messages.
Sure, and so she had a sort of false hope.
She had false hope. But what we do know is, and following the dates, is the 21st of March 2002, Millie Dowler went missing. But we know that from the telephone company records that she hadn't listened to her phone since the 20th of March. On the 24th of March, every single voicemail message was deleted. So any theory that there was a 72-hour automatic deletion does not work.
But until there is every message. The reason it is important is that until there is firm evidence that somebody, a newspaper journalist or investigator, deleted her voicemail deliberately. I mean, let me put it to you what Stephen Glover, a media commentator, wrote in the Independent newspaper. If the Guardian had not published its inaccurate 4th of July allegation in the sensational terms it did, saying that the voicemails had been deliberately deleted, events could have gone differently. The Sunday Red Top, the News of the World, might not have been closed by a panic-stricken Rupert Murdoch, and the Leveson Inquiry, the inquiry into press ethics that is now underway, might not have been set up by an equally panic-stricken David Cameron. Do you see any truth in that?
No, I mean, that's completely far-fetched. Lord Justice Leveson has said that the inquiry was not just looking into Millie Dowler's voicemail deletions. We just don't know what happened with the deletions. We do know messages were deleted. We do know that it wasn't automatic. We do know that the News of the World hacked her phone, listened to her voicemail messages. We do know that the family were given false hope anyway, that there were activities by News of the World reporters who published a story based on voicemail messages. That is without a doubt. They pursued that.
But there is no evidence, as far as the police are concerned. They're saying that there's no evidence that anybody connected with the News of the World deleted these voicemail messages.
That might be the case, but there's no evidence that they didn't either.
But as a result of that, this whole furore, the News of the World and Rupert Murdoch paid a large sum of money, millions, to the Dowlers in compensation. One British newspaper now, the Daily Mail, has asked whether any of that money is going to be paid back.
Well that's it. It's not going to be paid back. It's preposterous. We know that the News of the World, and the News of the World accepts this, that the News of the World had information, that they thought that they had information for a story that they were running, that Millie Dowler was still alive. Over a week before, they notified the police that they had this information. They withheld information. Cruelly, they didn't tell the parents that their daughter might still be alive. That was evil, evil coming from the News of the World. And why that is being defended by the Mail, why they bother to ask the question, why they bother to make such preposterous allegations to me, asking questions. Really, what needs to happen is an internal inquiry at the Mail from the Mail's editor as to why the journalists phoned me up and even asked that question, because they ought to be ashamed of themselves.
You, yourself, you didn't just take a telephone call from the Mail. You were also, for a time, put under surveillance by the newspapers, secret surveillance, as were your family. How did you become aware of that?
That was almost a circumstantial coincidence. I was aware that there'd been a report. I was told that a report had been prepared on me. The News International deny that they did that. Although the information in the report isn't true, there's enough truth about it that involves some surveillance. There was or some inquiries about my background. It talks about my education, about my health. There would have been some information that they would have had, some whoever prepared that report. There was nobody else who would have been interested in that report other than perhaps a journalist at News International.
That's how you found out about it.
I found out about that report, and then I found out that it was suggested by a television company who contacted me to say that they'd been given information by a former News of the World employee that my voicemails had been hacked. I said, well, there's also apparently a report that was pursued. What happened was I made a complaint to the police about that surveillance. The police eventually obtained information from News International, which included a video recording of my ex-wife and my daughter, who was 14 years old at the time.
Did you not think at that point, perhaps it's time to back off because other people are at risk here?
Not at all. I mean, that's just not in my character. It's not how it is.
You say it's not in your character, but then there are other people who are being put on the line here.
The only way that you can protect other people, whatever you do, is to fight back. You always have to fight back. Otherwise, you know, that's what's wrong with the whole system. If people are too scared...
It's interesting that you use language like fight back, because sometimes, just listening to you now, you talk less as a lawyer and almost more as a campaigner. I mean, do you feel that this is personal now?
It's not personal. It's not a crusade. I'm a lawyer. I pursue cases for clients, and I will represent clients. Oddly enough, I would have hacked it for News International if they would have instructed me first, and perhaps I might have done a better job of it than it was.
But you do talk in personal terms. You do talk in pugnacious terms. This is a quote from a profile of you recently. You've got so many of the big law firms on this, and on the other side, you've got me. I haven't even got a secretary. I've got one hand because of your multiple sclerosis. And, you know, if I had two hands, I'd tie one behind my back because they need a head start. I mean, that's fairly pugnacious for a lawyer.
Well, I suspect there is fighting talk. I mean, maybe what I see as being a lawyer also involves my personality. I will fight back for someone. Look, what I say to any client, and not just in terms of the phone hacking cases, but historically, I've always said to a client, this is about, anything is about bullying. And if on the first day at school, if the school bully comes up to you and says, give me your dinner money, if you give them your dinner money, you'll be doing it every day of your school life. So actually what you have to do is turn around and give the bully a punch on the nose and he'll run off. And if you can't do that, you need the big person, a big person to stand next to you to do that. And I always tell clients, well, I will be the big person who will stand next to you.
How widespread do you think the culture of phone hacking has been at newspapers?
I think it's incredible to suggest that. I mean, I almost feel sorry for the News of the World. It obviously wasn't just the News of the World that was doing this. It's unrealistic.
What's your evidence of that?
For all sorts of reasons. The police initially said this was 2004, 2006 at the News of the World, and one inquiry agent, Glenn Mulcair. The police now say this is probably a lot, 2001 to 2006 period. It's unrealistic to think that if a journalist was doing it at the News of the World but moved somewhere else, he wasn't...
But it's supposition rather than hard evidence.
Well, there are all sorts of suggestions by people who say that information has appeared about them in other newspapers which could have only been obtained by hacking into their phone.
Do you think that phone hacking can ever be justified?
Yes, I think there probably ought to be a public interest defence, but there's a different thing between, you know, what they were... Look, there could be no justification for hacking into the phone and listening into the voicemail of a dead 13-year-old.
Well, I don't think anybody would... Nobody would disagree with you on that, but the question is... I mean, the reason I ask the question is that we have this inquiry, principally as a function of the actions with Millie Dowler's voicemail, into press ethics and where you draw the line. My question to you is, how difficult is it to draw that line?
Well, I don't think it's that difficult. I think people can see...
Well, how do you define public interest?
I think people can see what's the difference between the public interest and as lawyers talk about what interests the public. Obviously, we have this prurient interest into what goes on. If, for example, a politician espouses a hypocritical view of, say, family values, but at the same time is having an adulterous affair, then it's right to expose the hypocrisy.
So if hypocrisy could be enough of a defence?
I think hypocrisy of a politician, for example, is enough of a defence.
An act that is illegal, because phone hacking is illegal at the moment.
Yes, but I think it probably ought to have, like most things, ought to have a public interest defence.
Well, which you could see, for example, if the journalists were exposing an act of criminal wrongdoing, but hypocrisy, that's much political hypocrisy.
Political hypocrisy.
But that's a difficult, again, it's a difficult distinction to draw. And also, what you're essentially doing is saying that hypocrisy would allow you to commit an act that is strictly illegal.
Strictly illegal, but I think the procedures that ought to be adopted is not a journalist deciding on his own behalf that he should be doing something, but the journalist should be talking to his editor, who should make a decision. It ought to be a unanimous decision between the editor, the in-house lawyer, who ought to be a responsible and upright person, and perhaps an external adjudicator or representative, maybe another lawyer or something, so that the three of them would have to say, this is justified, to back up a story that you've already
got.
Well,
it's often the way in which newspapers and the press and the media work in any case, is that as a reporter you talk to your editor, you often talk to your in-house lawyer. I'm just wondering, though, where this all ends up, because that's quite a liberal suggestion from you in many ways. But there are a lot of people out there who say there is a danger with Lord Justice Leveson's inquiry, at which you've given evidence, that in the end, in order to draw a line as to where the standard of press ethics will be, he will inevitably end up muzzling a free press here.
It's a joke to suggest that we have a free press at the moment. What we have is a press that is controlled by the proprietors of the press.
That's not the issue. Not the issue as to ownership. The issue is to standards, as to what you can do as a journalist.
It is the interest, because if you look at a free press, the perfect example of a free press is the phone hacking scandal and the failure to report on it by all the other newspapers, because a free press would have reported on it. It would have told everybody what was happening. And journalists who work for newspapers have not been able to write about things because their owners, it comes down to all sorts of issues of plurality of ownership, their owners have said, if you do this, there is a problem. So we've got to have firm guidelines for reporters. Look, most journalists are good, honest people who do their job. Look, if you're exposing a Watergate or if you're exposing an MP's expenses scandal, the suggestion is it was obtained by a breach of the law, but it was a good law to be breached because it helped. It's a democratic value. The population knew about these things.
Mark Lewis, thank you very much for being on Hard Talk.
Thank you.